This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Nobody told me if I'd known we in the danger zone.
The way the science is going at the moment, we're going to see a rise of about 2 degrees centigrade or so by the middle of this century. That's very hard to imagine that we'd be any less than that. But there's now a small but very real risk that we could hit 4 degrees centigrade by the end of this century. Now, the prospects of 3 and 4 degrees centigrade of warming are absolutely dire. I mean, we cannot risk that at all. It is an extreme and unstable climate, far beyond any safe zone that has nurtured our civilization. And we're going to be seeing unprecedented societal and ecological collapse at these sorts of levels. We can see escalating geopolitical instability and rising military tensions. And there will be no real economy to talk about. There's no reduction in GDP. We'll be looking at systemic collapse.
That is what's at stake. You just heard Dr. Kevin Anderson, professor of energy and climate change at Manchester University and Uppsala. He is a former director of the prestigious Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research in the United Kingdom. Later in the show, you will hear Kevin and clips from a half dozen other top experts at the National Emergency Briefing in London, November 27th. First, two quick guests with science that matters. Why did Earth get hotter faster in the last few years? Professor Brian Soden says the phenomenal heat burst of 2023 and 24 were not caused by a change in ship pollution regulations. Then, yes, Africans are dying in the heat we added to the atmosphere. From the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, Dr. Cheng Hu on the study Escalated Heat Wave Mortality Risk in Sub-Saharan Africa Under Recent Warming Trend. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Warning with Radio EcoShock. Why did Earth get hotter faster in the last few years? Why is Earth retaining more solar energy? World-renowned climate scientist James Hansen pointed to ship exhaust particles changing the clouds. Not everyone agrees. PhD student Chan Yong Park and Professor Brian Soden investigated. They found negligible contribution from aerosols to recent trends in Earth's energy imbalance. That was published in Science Advances, November 28, 2025. Co-author Brian Soden is with the Rosenstiel School of Marine, Atmospheric, and Earth Science at the University of Miami. From Miami, Brian Soden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
What is Earth energy imbalance, and why do we need to know about it?
So the Earth's energy imbalance is a measure of how much more energy is coming into the planet versus what is leaving the planet. And as the Earth is currently absorbing more energy than it's losing to space, and as it does so, that causes the Earth to warm up. And we've noticed that this imbalance between the energy coming in and the energy going out has been increasing over time. And that is raising concerns about the potential rate of future warming.
A NASA chart of Earth's energy balance year by year shows a lot of variation. For example, it looks like the planet's energy was completely balanced in 2010. So what is the trend?
Well, the trend is for more incoming energy from the sun versus the amount of infrared or terrestrial emission that's going to space.
I thought that it was going up over a couple of decades and so that it's always up there, but it seems like it goes up and down quite a bit.
Sure, there is year-to-year variations in this because there's just natural variability, say, in the amount of cloud cover or the amount of energy that's emitted out to space. And the cloud cover affects both the amount of energy absorbed from the sun and the amount of energy that's emitted back out to space. So we do see natural changes from year to year. But two points to make. One is that there's more energy coming in than going out, and that's a reflection of the impact that increasing greenhouse gases have had on the climate. That if there's more energy going in than going out, then that's causing the climate to warm. But more concerning is that the rate of this heat uptake, this net heat uptake, is increasing over time, and that will accelerate the rate of warming.
Okay, now we know the atmosphere is not just air. It's full of all sorts of dirty things, countless tiny particles floating along. We call them aerosols. They can be natural or they can be created by humans. Your study finds aerosols affect clouds in two different ways, one direct and the other indirect. Why don't we begin with direct? How does incoming sunlight and lowering the energy imbalance and cooling the surface, how does that work?
As you stated, these tiny, tiny solid or liquid particles that float around in the atmosphere, we refer to as aerosols, and they have both natural and anthropogenic sources. And what the vast majority of these do is they tend to scatter and reflect sunlight back to space. So that reduces the amount of incoming sunlight that reaches the surface, and that has a cooling effect. One of the things that we've seen is over the past few decades, the amount of aerosols or pollution, if you want to call it that, from man-made sources like the burning of fossil fuels has declined from the U.S. and Western Europe over the last couple of decades. And that led to concern that this reduced concentration of aerosols might be unintentionally contributing to the growing energy imbalance and therefore contributing to an increase in the rate of warming.
So in 2023, a Dutch researcher, Leon Simons, became co-author of a big paper by Dr. James Hansen. And that paper cited new regulations limiting sulfur and ship exhaust, leading to fewer clouds in the Pacific shipping lanes, enough to reveal more heating since 2020, they say. So did your research find reduction in clouds and ship emissions as a major factor changing energy in the Northern Hemisphere?
Well, we looked at all aerosols, not just those from ship emissions, but all sources of anthropogenic aerosols as well as natural aerosols. So in the Northern Hemisphere, we do see a decline in sulfate aerosols, which is the primary anthropogenic aerosol, over the last two decades or so. But that's been balanced by an increase in natural emissions of aerosols in the Southern Hemisphere that's been largely driven by some very extreme wildfires in Australia as well as the eruption of the Hunga Tonga volcano. So what you see is a decline in aerosols over the Northern Hemisphere that's entirely offset by an increase in natural aerosols in the Southern Hemisphere. And so globally, the net result of that is that there's been very little change in the global concentration of aerosols.
And you found even indirect changes to Earth's reflection due to the massive wildfires in Australia changing sea life. Could you tell us about that?
The main focus of this paper was looking at how aerosols, in addition to reflecting sunlight directly, they also act as condensation nuclei, or you can think of them as cloud seeds, which are tiny little particles that help cloud droplets form. And as you increase the concentration of aerosols, that tends to make clouds brighter and cover a larger area, and vice versa. If you decrease aerosols, that tends to make clouds less bright and cover smaller areas. So, you know, one of the real concerns in these changes in aerosols is not so much their direct effect on the reflection of sunlight, but what we call an indirect effect, which is their influence on making clouds brighter or more extensive. And so we used a special data set that we had developed that kind of isolates this aerosol influence on clouds to look at how the changes in aerosol concentration were affecting the brightness and the amount of sunlight that these clouds reflect. And similar to the changes in the direct effect of aerosols, we see that this indirect effect, or the effect of aerosols on cloud reflectance, you see that becoming darker in the Northern Hemisphere due to the decline in aerosols, so anthropogenic emissions. But that is almost entirely offset by an increase in cloud reflectance from the increase in natural aerosols in the Southern Hemisphere.
So is it fair to say your research reduces or even negates the argument that ship regulations led to an imbalance in Earth's energy flows?
Yeah, we don't find any evidence to suggest that the energy imbalance is being driven by these ship emissions. In fact, we find quite the opposite, that it's not just the decline in ship emissions, but also the longer term decline in the use of coal and other fossil fuels that also introduce aerosols into the atmosphere, that neither of those are really contributing in a significant way to the changes in the Earth's energy imbalance we've seen over the last two decades.
Well, we all like a simple solution, and if it isn't shipping changes, I look to find final answers to this change in Earth's energy balance in your paper, but that's not what you set out to do, was it?
We wanted to investigate. I mean, we would have been more than happy to have a final explanation for what is causing this increasing heat uptake. But what we came out with is that kind of what is the leading candidate that's been suggested so far doesn't seem to be it, which is aerosols. So if it's not aerosols, what is driving this trend in Earth's energy imbalance is still an open question. It could be the response of clouds to surface warming, and that's concerning because that would suggest a kind of very high climate sensitivity and very large amount of warming in response to increases in CO2. Alternatively, it could also be that our understanding of natural variability in the Earth's energy imbalance, which we get from looking at climate models, that may simply underestimate the magnitude of internal variability, natural variability, and these ups and down wiggles that you were commenting on. So, you know, another explanation could be that that this trend is also part of natural variability.
And you suggest a couple of other, I won't say suspects, but contributors to this. And one is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is a large ocean atmospheric pattern out in the Pacific. But the other one is a little more technical and harder to grasp. You talk about shortwave sunlight and longwave radiation and the feedback in the clouds in the shortwave. That's a little hard for us to grasp, but could you introduce us to what shortwave feedback in clouds is?
Sure. Yeah, that was, so you can understand climate feedback processes. Probably the simplest example of that is to think of snow and ice cover. So snow and ice cover obviously reflect a lot of sunlight back to space. And when you warm the climate, you're going to melt things that are frozen. So you're going to have less snow and ice cover. This will allow more solar, or what we call shortwave radiation, to be absorbed at the surface. And if you absorb more of that shortwave radiation, that warms the planet further, and that leads to more snow and ice melt, which leads to more absorption of solar or shortwave radiation. So that's an example of a feedback loop, where the energy flow is being influenced by the change in temperature at the surface. And so, similar to how ice and snow can respond to a warming climate, you can also get changes in clouds that are directly due to a change in surface temperature. And so we call those feedback processes. And as I mentioned earlier, clouds can affect the flow of energy both in the solar or shortwave part of the spectrum, as well as in the infrared, or what we call the longwave part of the spectrum. So there are these surface temperature-driven responses of clouds that can also modulate the incoming solar radiation or the outgoing infrared radiation. So that would be one other potential explanation for this, but I think that would be the most concerning of all the potential explanations, because that would suggest that we have a stronger positive feedback from clouds than what most studies would think is likely. And that would mean more warming.
Well, this question is literally still up in the air. A 2023 study by Raumann and colleagues found satellite records suggested, quote, clouds did not further cool nor heat the planet over the last two decades, end quote. So despite all we've heard, we still don't know whether clouds amplify or dampen global warming, really. Are we back to zero on this controversy?
No, I don't think so. I'm not familiar with that study per se, so I can't really comment on it, but there's been a number of studies that have shown that this change in Earth's energy imbalance is being driven primarily by changes in clouds. So I think there's a, you know, decent consensus around that point.
Do you think cloud science will get much clearer in the next few years?
I certainly hope so. I know this is obviously a very important topic, and there's a lot of very smart people working on it. It will be important to understand what's driving this change, no question.
And what are you working on next, Brian?
We're continuing to work on this area, and by we, I mean largely my students like Chen Young Park and other students I have in my group. You know, there's one other possible explanation. We didn't really discuss it in the paper. Is that this hemispheric asymmetry between having increasing aerosols in one hemisphere and decreasing aerosols in another hemisphere, that asymmetry between the hemispheres can cause significant changes in the large-scale atmospheric circulation. So something we call the intertropical convergence zone, which is this narrow band of rainfall that tends to lie near the equator, its north and south location is very sensitive to this hemispheric gradient in aerosol concentration. And so one possible explanation that we're looking at is that this hemispheric asymmetry in the aerosol trends between decreasing northern hemisphere and increasing southern hemisphere aerosols can affect the circulation and through that also affect cloud cover. And that might be kind of a very circuitous way in which these aerosol trends could be even more indirectly altering cloud cover and perhaps a possible mechanism to change the energy imbalance.
Well, that has a big bearing on geoengineering proposals, too. I mean, there have been suggestions to just spray sulfur particles up around the Arctic, trying to save the Arctic ecosystem. But if there's an imbalance between the hemispheres and that makes changes, it looks like we need to know a lot more.
Yeah, and I think this is pretty well understood. We've known this for some time that, you know, these hemispheric changes in aerosol concentrations are strong regulators of things like the intertropical convergence zone and so forth. And so many geoengineering studies, which not the ones that you're referring to, they're just focused on the Arctic, but ones that are more global in scope, actually part of the strategy there is to manage this hemispheric contrast, not just the total concentration of aerosols, but what the hemispheric contrast in aerosols are in order to mitigate any, say, changes in the rain belt.
From Miami, we've been speaking with Professor Brian Soden. He is co-author of a surprising paper published November 28th, Negligible Contribution from Aerosols to Recent Trends in Earth's Energy Imbalance. Brian, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Coming up, in a large hall of legislators and big names of climate science lay it all out. The United Kingdom and every country is in an undeclared state of emergency. Stay tuned. More heat at the tropics? No big worry, right? People there are used to that. Except large numbers of all ages are dying in Africa from the heat. We don't have a number, nobody is keeping track, but now we get a look at heat mortality in sub-Saharan Africa, and the new paper is loaded with surprises we all should know. The title is Escalated Heatwave Mortality Risk in Sub-Saharan Africa Under Recent Warming Trend. Our guest is lead author Dr. Chung Hu from the Harvard Chan School of Public Health. We can find thousands of predictions for climate and heat in North America, Europe, Australia, and China. There's very little work on Africa. That continent is a blind spot in global media as well. Cheng, what brought you and your team into the study of growing deadly heat risk in sub-Saharan Africa?
the background is I came from China, and I did a lot of research in Europe. Right now I'm in U.S., and that's just a lot of study about the health impact of climate change in not only China, but also in Europe and U.S. But due to the lack of data that in Africa, we cannot find a very robust and very helpful evidence about the health impact of climate change on the population health in the African. So since we switched this focus, and we recently found some reliable health data set from the African based on several cohort surveys, and we found that it's quite useful, and just want to look into the health impact of the heat wave in Africa use this kind of a survey data set. And fortunately, we found that the results are quite reliable, which can help us to get more insight into this kind of topic, which has been oversight for quite a long while.
Where is Sub-Saharan Africa, and what countries are included in your study?
Sub-Saharan Africa refers to the region of Africa south of the Saharan Desert. We studied 11 sites across 8 countries, spanning from Senegal and Burkina Faso in the west, and Kenya and Ethiopia at the east, down to South Africa. So the diversity was important, not only included the climate, but also different economic conditions got involved.
Have there been deadly heat waves there already?
Yes, it's getting even worse now. There have been specific extreme events. In 1916, a heat wave in West Africa saw temperature hit more than 50 degrees Celsius in parts of Mali. More recently, in April last year, West Africa experienced what scientists called a dangerous humid heat wave that recent climate change made 10 times more likely happen than last decade.
The Arctic and Europe are warming faster than other parts of the world. Does this mean Africa will not heat up much as our emissions climb? If the world warms by 2 or 3 degrees C on a global average, does sub-Saharan Africa go up with the average or differently?
Actually, Africa is warming faster than most places across the globe, about 1.5 times the degree than global average. So if the world warmed 2 degrees, parts of the Africa could see 3 degrees warming.
In the tropics, temperatures don't change much as they do in the northern hemisphere. I mean, the days and the nights aren't that different, and they're not different around the year that much. So people there must be used to the heat, aren't they? Why would a couple of degrees more matter?
On the one hand, yes, people are used to heat there. But adaptation needs more than just biology. It needs infrastructure. The 3 key points. First, we are not just talking about normal heat. We are talking about extreme heat. Heat wave pushes temperature beyond what any human body can handle. Second, most people in our study area have no air conditioned usage, often no reliable electricity, sometimes no, not even proper housing. When nights stay hot, their body can never recover. A small increase matters highly.
There's a new preprint paper, Deadly Heat Exposure in an Urbanized World. They find by 2080, about 500 million people in sub-Saharan Africa will try to survive through more than 30 days of deadly heat every year. But another paper, Guillaume Rohat, in April 4, 2019, finds, quote, the influence of changes in climate alone are minimal. Their projections of human exposure to dangerous heat in African cities says the real drivers are increasing population coupled with a rush from the countryside to big cities. That sets the stage for excess heat to become more deadly. Your thoughts about these various influences?
I think both are true, and they actually amplify each other. On the one hand, yes, urbanization and the population growth increased exposure, more people in hot cities with poor housing, but our results show something additional. The heat itself is becoming more challenging. Nighttime heat-related mortality risk increased 80% even with the same population. So it's not either or. Climate change is making heat deadly, while urbanization is putting more people in harm's way. Together, that's a crisis.
In North America and Europe, elderly people account for most heat deaths. What is the age spread for mortality in the African countries you studied?
It's very different from West. Working-age adults, I mean people in their prime, also had a very high death risk, likely from outdoor labor. Children under 5 were highly vulnerable too. So it's not just an elderly problem in Africa.
We also tend to assume females are more at risk of dying during heat waves than men. At least some medical studies assume that. What did you find?
That's another surprise we found. Men were more vulnerable to heat waves. We think this is occupationally a difference. In fact, over 60% of men working in agriculture or construction in Africa, outdoors in extreme heat. Women show vulnerable mainly in nighttime heat, possibly from a poor indoor environment.
And North America and Europe have extensive climate records and mortality records. So what is the situation in Africa?
It's very tough. We use the civilian states that have been tracking population for years, but compared to wealthy countries, African state infrastructure is extremely limited. That's part of the reason not so many studies focusing on African populations right now.
Yes, your study doesn't include the most populous country, Nigeria, with at least 237 million people. Is that the reason you just couldn't find good records for it?
There's no data available in Nigeria, so unfortunately we cannot include Nigeria in our study.
Your team found three different types of heat waves, each with their own profile. Please describe those for us.
First, daytime heat wave we define as this occur when maximum daily temperature exceeds the local 19th percentile for two or more consecutive days. Second, nighttime heat wave when daily minimum temperature stays above the 19th percentile for two or more consecutive days. Third, compound day and night heat wave when both conditions occur spontaneously.
In the African countries you studied, the hottest time of day is not necessarily what leads to death. What is the real danger time?
We found a less significant impact from daytime heat, as you said, but the nighttime heat wave when the minimum temperature stays above 19% percentile, we found a 80% increase in mortality risk. This is a really hidden killer. Also, compound day and night heat wave, when both conditions happened at the same time, we saw a significant increase in mortality risk.
What happens medically at night that connects hot nights to added deaths during a heat wave?
Nighttime is when our bodies need to cool down and recover from heat stress during the day. When nighttime temperature remains higher, several things happen. Your core body temperature cannot drop enough, sleep quality affected, and cardiovascular strain accumulated. Without access to cooling, remember, most of our cases we talk about lack of air conditioning or even reliable electricity for fan use. There's no physiological recovery period, so it becomes a cumulative stress.
After the deadly heat wave of 2003, Europe significantly reduced heat deaths. They're still losing over 50,000 people a year during the last couple of years to extreme heat, but not tens of thousands in a week. Can Africa adapt in the same way?
the adaptation pathways are different. Europe invests air conditioning, cooling centers, and also early warning systems, and had a healthy care infrastructure to respond. In our study region, those options are not available. We need context-specific solutions with less cost, like passive cooling through house design, reflecting roof materials, and early warning systems that include night and temperature forecasts.
A 2023 study measured temperature as high as 45 degrees C, 113 Fahrenheit, inside living rooms in Ghana, mainly under metal roofing. And that was right in the capital of Accra. Building on science about the urban heat effect, we now have to add extreme indoor heat in low-income housing. Should that danger be included in research?
Yes, the Ghana study is very important. Our study only used outdoor temperatures, actually, but the people are dying inside their homes. We absolutely need more research on indoor heat, especially during the night.
In the developed world, the governments and media send out heat warnings, sometimes days in advance. Get ready, people, they say. But the best tell us about hot nights, too. That's on our TV weather forecasts, and they show the minimum temperature. Talk to us about the need for better heat warning systems in Africa.
This is very urgent. Right now, more than 60% of Africans have no heat warming at all. The system that exists currently in Ghana and Nigeria, for example, only warns about daytime maximum temperature or daily mean temperature. But our study shows that nighttime heat is a real killer. Warning system must include minimum temperatures in addition to the daily maximum temperature and the daily mean temperature we already have.
There's a lot of data blindness about Africa. Maybe we get comfortable about the smallest emitters living there taking big hits from global warming because we don't know. We don't know what's happening. And who can stand up to bring the plight of African people into our science, into our media, and into our minds?
Yes, the population faced the worst impacts are the least studied. In addition to the data limitations, we also need more funding for African climate health research, more African researchers leading this work. It's climate justice, as you said. You cannot adapt to what you are not measuring or understanding.
What are you working on now?
I'm focusing on children and women, examining how heat affects child malnutrition and mental health condition in Africa with local partners. We need to understand the specific pathways, not just the association we already have, so we can design the target intervention for the future.
I have to admit, I don't totally understand what you mean by that. Could you tell us a little bit more so that I can grasp it?
Let me put it in another way. Climate warming not only affects child malnutrition directly, but also affect the infrastructures or the food systems that support the child's healthy growth. They all affect it. So we try to find the significant pathways, the most, like the food security system or the social security system, and try to identify the important role within it.
From the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, we've been speaking with Dr. Chung Ho, lead author of the paper, Escalated Heatwave Mortality Risk in Sub-Saharan Africa Under Recent Warming Trend. You can find out more with links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Chung, thank you for taking science to places where others do not.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What does it mean? Kind of a warning, I think.
Most of us are getting hammered with extreme weather worse and more often. Decades of research from hundreds of thousands of scientists around the world show it very clearly. We are headed into a disaster never seen by human beings. Where is the call for emergency action to save us? For now, it is in the United Kingdom. On November 27, 2025, over 150 parliamentarians and business, media leaders and NGOs, they gathered in the Central Hall in Westminster, London, for a national emergency briefing on the climate and nature crisis. I was not planning on broadcasting this UK briefing. Neither was popular YouTuber Dave Borlas. The title of his weekly Just Have a Think video on November 30th is, "This is not the video I had planned to make." It's just too important. Our climate is destabilized, showing up as record-smashing heat, rainfall, storms, wildfires, winds, whiplash from one season to another in a single day, and then it quickly gets worse. The Just Have a Think video channel is a home for balanced, rational thought. Here, Dave Borlas brought together key clips we all need to hear better than I could do. I edited this lightly for radio, keeping the best for an international audience. Let's join Dave for a tour of the latest on extreme weather, climate, and Earth's emergency.
The event was called the National Emergency Briefing, and it pulled absolutely no punches in its explanation of the climate emergency we now find ourselves in, both as a nation and as a global civilization. If we lived in a rational world, the presentations given last Thursday would have been priority live streamed on every network news channel, and the event would have made that day's headlines. In reality, it wasn't broadcast by any of the big four UK TV channels, and it didn't make the evening news. I guess I should give you a bit of a clue as to exactly what this national emergency briefing was all about, shouldn't I? Well, essentially, 10 of the UK's leading experts in all these critical disciplines and activities each presented their own 10-minute or so briefing to MPs, peers of the realm, and the rest of us audience members, explaining the impact that our rapidly changing climate is already having in their particular sectors, and outlining the risks and hazards that are looming frighteningly large if we humans continue down the path we're currently on. The information and messages we all received in those presentations were at times very scary, at times just plain depressing, and once or twice actually surprisingly uplifting. But most important of all, it was absolutely essential that they were heard, especially by the policymakers who made the effort to attend. The event was chaired by Professor Mike Berners-Lee, who many of you will know from his research work on climate footprints and from his best-selling book called There Is No Planet B, which I've made a couple of videos about on this channel in the past. If you're a UK TV viewer, you will also undoubtedly be familiar with Chris Packham, both as a well-loved presenter of nature programmes on the Beeb and as a tireless campaigner on animal rights and climate issues. He calls a spade, does our Chris, and this snippet from his opening statement was characteristically blunt.
For those of you at the back, that looks like a pale blue dot. But that's us. That's our home. That's our one and only home. It's the only one we've got. It's where all of our species has lived and died. Everyone. Every single human. It's where we breathe, it's where we eat, we laugh, we cry, we love, we hate. And as far as we know, together with all the other wonderful life on Earth, we are the only known life forms in the universe. And we've got nowhere else to go. It's not thousands, it's not hundreds of thousands or millions of lives that are at risk. It's billions of lives that are at risk. We are one species on one planet.
So, you know, that sort of set the scene. But you have to quantify the rhetoric with data, don't you? That's exactly what this channel is all about. And it's precisely what we got from Professor Kevin Anderson, who's also not a man known for mincing his words.
If we measure the concentration of carbon dioxide in parts per million, and we look at that across the last, say, 800,000 years and compare that with today, we see a plot that looks like this. Now, that has a variation in that of about 100 parts per million going up and down, basically related to the ice ages. If we then focus in on the last 10,000 years, and that's the time when human societies have really flourished, What we see then is a pathway that is much more stable in carbon dioxide. The variation has only been about 20 parts per million in that period of time. And so we've had a very stable temperature and a very stable climate during the flourishing of our societies. If we then look at the end of this, and so this is really where we began to burn fossil fuels, in about 1850-ish. And we're about 280 parts per million by volume at that particular time. And if we look at that where we are today, we're now at 424 parts per million, almost overnight. We've gone to these ridiculously high levels, and it's rising rapidly every single year. The way the science is going at the moment, we're going to see a rise of about 2 degrees centigrade or so by the middle of this century. That's very hard to imagine that we're going to be any less than that. But there's now a small but very real risk that we could hit 4 degrees centigrade by the end of this century. Now, the prospects of 3 and 4 degrees centigrade of warming are absolutely dire. I mean, we cannot risk that at all. It is an extreme and unstable climate, far beyond any safe zone that has nurtured our civilization. And we're going to be seeing unprecedented societal and ecological collapse at these sorts of levels. We can see escalating geopolitical instability and rising military tensions. And there will be no real economy to talk about. There's no reduction in GDP. We'll be looking at systemic collapse.
But of course, we're already seeing some of those effects right now, aren't we? Here's Hayley Fowler, Professor of Climate Change Impact at Newcastle University.
By 2050, one in four properties, 8 million in England, will be at risk of flooding. And new research by my group shows that UK winter rainfall has increased by 10% since 1980 because of the fossil fuels we're putting into the atmosphere. Now, an extra 30 millimetres of rainfall each winter sounds really small. But across the UK, that's 7.3 billion cubic metres of extra water. It's the same as 3 million Olympic-sized swimming pools, with an effect on flooding. This trend is some 25 years ahead of global climate model predictions. The extreme heat of 19th of July 2022, you'll remember that. Across the UK, records were shattered. Temperatures over 40 degrees were recorded for the first time. It caused around 3,000 excess deaths. In fact, heat waves in Europe are intensifying faster than anywhere in the world and much faster than climate models predict. UK fire services no longer have the resources to keep the public safe in extreme heat, and as heat waves get longer and hotter, fires will become more common. The Climate Change Committee's latest assessment is very clear. The UK is not adapting fast enough to a rapidly changing climate. The committee highlights three major gaps: weak governance, unclear responsibilities, and insufficient funding. It's sobering when you realise that this is the least extreme climate you will experience in your lifetime. Until we stop burning fossil fuels, extreme weather will continue to get worse.
Not really the sort of world we want to leave for our kids and grandkids, is it? If you're a regular viewer, you'll have heard me talking about the tipping points in Earth systems that are rapidly coming our way as a consequence of those rising temperatures, and which can suddenly turbocharge the climate into an even more hazardous state. The dangers of those tipping points were recently set out in graphic detail in this report, co-authored by Tim Lenton, who's Professor of Climate Change and Earth System Science at University of Exeter. And Professor Lenton was at the National Emergency Briefing to give us a quick summary.
If you're wondering what a tipping point is, you could just lean back on your chair to that balance point where you know that a small change is going to make a big difference to your state or your fate. There'll be a self-propelling change from one stable state of the system to another.
But it was Tim's explanation of the consequences of a collapsing AMOC that really gave pause for thought, especially for those of us living here in Western Europe.
In London, it's minus 20 degrees C and 3 frozen months of the year. And in Edinburgh, it's minus 30 degrees C and 5.5 frozen months of the year. And yet the summers will still be hotter than today because it's a 2 degrees warmer world, not a 1.4 degrees warmer world. And the simple version is it eliminates the possibility to grow crops in the UK. But that's possibly the least of our worries, because there'd be a major water security crisis. We calculate that there'd be not enough water from the winters to get through the summers in the southeast of England, where most of the people are, like us today. And then in the global context, This is a simple calculation of what passing this tipping point does for the viable areas for growing two major staple crops, wheat and maize, worldwide, and they're reduced by more than a half. So it's a global food security crisis.
And that brings us neatly to the difficult conversation that absolutely nobody I know ever seems to want to have, and that's how we continue to feed ourselves as a society in the context of our rapidly changing climate. Here's Paul Berends, Professor in Environmental Change at the University of Oxford, to give us a bit of a clue.
For generations, a stable climate has given us reliable harvests. But that era, as we've heard, is gone. One study in a top journal found that before climate change, a major corn harvest failure might happen once every 16 years. At 1.5 degrees of warming, that rises to once every 3 years. At 2 degrees, it's once every other year. The good news is that the research is crystal clear on what we need to do. And, fortunately, it's healthier for us. We need a great food transformation, built on four main pillars: shifting to plant-rich diets, reducing food waste, improving production, and increasing climate resilience. Research from our team and many others across the UK show that healthy, sustainable diets can still include some meat and dairy, just far less of it. Now, I know this can be politically difficult to talk about, but we have to be straight with people about the choices ahead. Because if we don't lead this change on the front foot, we'll be forced into this change anyway as food shocks intensify and as animals are hit harder by climate change than the crops. And if we can be on the front foot, this is where the story becomes one of extraordinary opportunity. I talked before about threats to food supply, but this is how we can create climate resilience. We can use some of that spared land to grow more of the food we need here in the UK. It will cut over-reliance on imports, and you can feed many more people per hectare on a plant-rich diet.
It's not just food, though, is it? Climate impacts are affecting every aspect of our economy and pretty much all major economies across the planet. Angela Francis is Director of Policy Solutions at the UK arm of the Worldwide Fund for Nature.
In every transition, every industrial and agricultural revolution, new technologies replace the old, societies change, you get innovation and productivity leaps, and there are winners and losers, and the losers lobby the government. The investment the UK needs to make to stay on the CCC's balanced pathway is equivalent to about £4 billion a year. That's 0.2% of GDP. The majority of that investment would be paid by the private sector. With the right incentives and policy, they would cover 40 to 90% of what is needed. And the public sector share could be funded by national banks and asset-backed lending, where the economics stack up like they do here. Globally, wind is being built out three times the pace we thought it would be in 2015. Solar installations are 15 times faster than we thought they would be. EVs, were expected to have 20% of the market in 2030, have hit that last year, and they're now expected to double market share by 2030. And because faster is cheaper, the cost of the whole UK transition is now 73% cheaper than we thought it would be just 5 years ago. Inflation would have been 7% lower if we had decarbonised the power sector ahead of Russia invading Ukraine. It would have been a further 9% lower if our food system wasn't linked to fossil fuels through fertiliser prices, which went up 400% at that same time. And it would have been 11% lower if we'd have switched to heat pumps earlier.
So there are clearly policies that our elected representatives can enact that could start to drag us out of our current predicament. We just need to convince those representatives to do the right thing. But of course, economic prosperity is entirely reliant on a healthy natural ecosystem, isn't it? And as Professor Natalie Seddon pointed out, even without collapsing AMOCs and unsustainable farming practices, there's still quite a lot to be concerned about here too.
We are facing a national emergency, not only because the climate is changing, but because the living systems that regulate that climate, protect our homes and feed our people, are breaking down here in one of the most nature-depleted nations on Earth. You know, recent analyses by the Green Finance Institute and others suggest that if we continue to degrade nature, nature-related risks could severely cut UK GDP in the coming decade, delivering a macroeconomic shock on the scale of major financial crises. So this is not an issue on the margins of policy. This is a national security issue. Without a living, healthy biosphere, there is no stable economy, no food, no water security, and no public health resilience. Luckily, we know what works, and the science points to the following. First of all, we need to consider nature as critical infrastructure. Second, we need to stop funding harm, and we need to reward restoration. Third, we need to redirect finance and measure what actually matters to us. You know, the financial system is sleepwalking into risk, escalating risk. This isn't about choosing between the economy and the environment. It's about recognizing that the economy is embedded within the environment and that the health of the nation depends on the living systems that sustain us and that we are part of.
Then there's the impacts of a warming world on human health, not just in the dangerously hot and in some cases already borderline uninhabitable regions around the equator, but increasingly in almost every society on Earth, including here in Europe, as Professor Hugh Montgomery laid out in no uncertain terms. I've left a link in the description to his full presentation, as I have for all the other presentations at the briefing, but here's just a quick taster of how Professor Montgomery, who is a time-served, battle-hardened NHS consultant, is feeling about the adverse consequences on people's health that he's already witnessing.
I work in climate change, but I'm an NHS lifer. I'm a barefoot doctor working in a North London intensive care unit. And my day job is emergencies. Whether it's global pandemics or 7/7 events such as this, terrorist attacks, or the more mundane, the people who come in acutely unwell on any one of the days of the week. I know what an emergency looks like, and I know how you respond to an emergency. And you don't respond to emergencies with talk and homeopathy. You respond with genuine action. We've had an honest conversation. I am scared. I'm 63. I may not have that much longer left on the planet. But I'm scared for my own life and future, and I'm absolutely terrified for that of my son. And you should be too. Is this an emergency? It is an emergency. Now it is an emergency, and it requires treatment. This is no longer a risk. Without action, these impacts are certainties. And the hazards are catastrophic. If we take action, we might survive to leave the hospital. If we do not, the outcome is absolutely certain. So I leave you with this thought. The climate emergency is a health emergency, and it's about time we started treating this one.
And if that's not scary enough for you, how about national security risks? Well, never fear, because the National Emergency Briefing had us covered on that one too. Here's Lieutenant General Richard Noogi with a couple of sobering thoughts.
I spent over 35 years in the army serving in, among other places, Northern Ireland, Iraq and Afghanistan. Even 5 to 10 years ago, if you'd raised climate change in the MOD, most people would nod politely, move on, with even a couple of top officials telling me, we're exempt climate change. But that has now changed. The MOD is now looking at environmental impacts with a team working on climate security, energy self-sufficiency for our forces, and how they can adapt to a rapidly changing planet. Why? Because the threat picture is shifting faster than we expected and faster than we anticipated. Climate shocks fuel global instability. When farmers can no longer earn a living, they're recruited by non-state actors. And we saw this in Afghanistan, and we saw this with ISIS in Iraq. The Arctic is becoming a new flashpoint due to the climate crisis directly. You've heard how sea ice is receding and at 4 times the rate of the rest of the world. But let's put that into a geopolitical perspective. The Russian Duma has claimed it's a Russian internal sea, whereas we treat the Arctic as international waters. So there's risk of conflict over access, over resources, and of course, over shipping routes. So the climate crisis is now shaping strategic and military competition. The encouraging part is that what we need to do on climate also makes Britain safer and more resilient. Take energy independence. Renewables, storage and a decentralised grid reduce our dependence on foreign oil and gas, and they're less vulnerable.
That last comment was very much endorsed by the final speaker at the event, Tessa Khan, who's an international lawyer and founder of a climate campaign organisation called Uplift. Let's get a couple of thoughts from Tessa, and then we'll talk about that letter I want you to sign.
An energy system based on renewables offers countless obvious economic advantages over one that runs on fossil fuels. Most obviously, the input, sun or wind, is free forever. Whereas if you buy a barrel of oil, as soon as you burn that, you need to buy another one. And the price that you pay for it is determined by a cartel of petrostates or subject to the whim of dictators. Further, the price of key technologies for a renewables-based power system has steeply declined in recent years, with the cost of electricity from offshore wind dropping more than 50% in the last decade, more than 70% in the case of solar, and the price of battery storage dropping more than 80% in that same period. Just as importantly, renewables are also vastly more efficient than fossil fuels. A typical petrol car only uses about 25% of the energy in its fuel to actually move its wheels. Most is lost as heat, and the fossil fuel system as a whole wastes about two-thirds of the raw energy that goes into it. So unsurprisingly, it's better not to dig up and burn million-year-old fossilised remains of plants and animals when renewable energy, which doesn't involve combustion and therefore constant heat loss, is so much more efficient.
See, I told you there were some uplifting bits, didn't I?
That was Dave Borlas with his selection from an amazing public briefing in the UK. Thank you, Dave. It was the National Emergency Briefing on the Climate and Nature Crisis, November 27th in London. On YouTube, search for "This is not the video I had planned to make." It had over 300,000 views last week. Pass it on. Surely all our listeners in America, Canada, Australia, and around the world know right in our hearts we need this movement, this emergency briefing, and emergency action right now in our own countries. Do what you can. We're out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
About a night.